Welcome to Climate Seasons, where we look behind the news headlines on the climate crisis and speak with activists, artists, psychologists, and more. Check out past episodes at climateseasons.org. On today's show, an interview with someone well known to most listeners, the Tacoma Park area's own U.S. Congressman Jamie Raskin, representing the 8th District of Maryland. We'll address the Civilian Climate Corps, an investigation into oil and gas industry shenanigans, a constitutional question, and a January 6th analogy. Welcome to the show, Congressman Raskin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for taking the time. There's a maelstrom of activity on climate change, of course, but I'd like to pose a variety of questions on your climate activities and your big picture thoughts on some of the issues at hand. But first, on a personal note, you live in Tacoma Park. Do you listen to Tacoma Radio?
Well, of course, and I've been on it many times, so I'm a big supporter. In fact, when I was in the state Senate, I helped to work to get the license from the FCC for Tacoma Radio to exist. So that was good fun.
Oh, fantastic. So I want to ask you briefly about the Civilian Climate Corps, like a climate version of AmeriCorps. The idea has been a popular part of the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better bill that's still being negotiated in the Congress. And I think you were supportive of an early version. Let's say the Civilian Climate Corps becomes a reality. What would this project mean for graduates of local high schools or colleges?
Well, the model, of course, is the Civilian Conservation Corps from the New Deal period, which deployed young people to participate in everything from building bridges to painting murals to running summer camps. But it was an effort to get the unemployed productively employed and engaged in socially productive activity. And the Civilian Conservation Corps is going to be doing the exact same thing, except with respect to climate readiness, conservation, insulation, the installation of solar panels, cleanups, you know, waterbed restoration, dealing with flooding. You know, all of these things are contemplated as part of the legislation, but it will obviously be up to the Climate Conservation Corps itself to work out the various projects with different federal agencies and departments, along with state and local agencies. But we know that there is a world of work to be done to have us ready for the weather calamities of the time, and also for getting us out of this through the development of, you know, wind energy, solar panels, and so on.
Yeah, it seems like a great answer to the question, what can I do? You know, go for one of these positions and see what you can do to help.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, everybody has internalized a lot of guidelines about how to live. And we know the things that we can do in terms of reduction of our carbon footprint and trying to go vegetarian or vegan, because we know that the animal livestock industry is such a terrible contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. You know, people have a sense of what they can do personally, but not necessarily what they can do professionally or in terms of their work to be part of it. And the Civilian Conservation Corps is an effort to try to mobilize young people to be involved in a socially coordinated activity that's going to make a real difference, whether it's the planting of trees, or it is the restoration of rivers and creeks because of erosion, or it's actually being involved in the creation of, you know, new climate solutions in different places. So we're hopeful that there will be a broad spectrum of activity that will be able to involve young people as farmers, as engineers, as educators, publicists, and environmentalists.
All right, thanks. Congressman Raskin, you and your colleagues are doing something unprecedented. You're investigating powerful oil and gas companies like ExxonMobil for their shady tactics to defend the fossil fuel industry. What have these guys been up to for decades, and what is your investigation aiming to do?
Well, of course, we expect them to defend themselves, and there's nothing necessarily nefarious or abnormal about that. But what we've been looking at is the role that big gas and big oil, Exxon, Chevron, other major companies played in discovering the reality of climate change very early on, as far back as the 1960s and 70s, and then suppressing the truth. And so there's a clear analogy here with what took place with the tobacco industry, which knew of the link between smoking and cancer a long time ago, but then did whatever they could to bury the scientific evidence of that connection. And it's really the same thing. They understood the way that carbon emissions were warming the planet and destabilizing the climate, but rather than invest in the research, share the research, and blow the whistle on it, they began to suppress it and lie about it. And that obviously makes them much more of a culprit than the rest of the society, even though all of us are implicated, of course, in carbon and methane emissions and climate change. But it's the industries that decided they were profiting too much from it and swept everything under the rug who are most at fault. And there is litigation about this around the country. A number of the companies are basically pleading a First Amendment excuse, as if there is some kind of First Amendment right to lie and to commit fraud. And we would consider this a fraud on the public. So a number of state attorneys general have brought lawsuits and are exploring lawsuits against the carbon kings about this wool being pulled over the eyes of the people.
They're lobbying, and anyone, again, is free to lobby for their interests, but there's some tactics and some front groups they're using. Is this also part of the investigation?
I don't know about that specifically. I know that we're looking for all information about the activities of the companies in learning the facts of climate change and then concealing the facts of climate change and trying to mislead the public through different propaganda exercises. So I suppose, you know, if there are front groups that are put up to advance disinformation and propaganda, that would definitely come within the scope of our investigations.
Is there a connect the dot here? How can pinning companies to the mat help advance the larger cause of getting off fossil fuels?
Well, if you go back to the tobacco analogy, I'd say there are two key points there. One is that discovering the culpability of the industry in maintaining public ignorance is a critical step in us taking responsibility for where we are and being able to move forward. The second thing is that if there is success, either litigation success or legislative success or negotiation success in getting them to come clean, to acknowledge their role, and then to pay for their sins, the money that's turned over can be used to help liberate people from the underlying injury. So in the case of tobacco, the tobacco settlements created big pots of money for the states to use to help wean the population off of the smoking addiction. And similarly, if some of the ill-gotten gains of the carbon barons are distributed to state and local governments in parens patriae, which means in pursuit of the good of the people, that's money that also could be used to contribute to climate readiness and undoing the negative effects of, you know, of the carbon poisoning of the planet. And that obviously has fallen in a disproportionate way on minority communities that have so often, you know, borne the brunt of global warming.
You're listening to Tacoma Radio, WOWDLP 94.3 FM. This is Climate Seasons with your host, Julie Handman, and my guest, U.S. Congressman Jamie Raskin. So, Congressman Raskin, pivoting to a constitutional question, do you think there may be a constitutional argument for preserving a stable climate? A group of young people in Juliana versus the U.S. are suing the federal government, arguing that government actions like giving subsidies to fossil fuel companies and others wreck the climate and thereby threaten their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, since it'd be tough to live on a degraded planet. Again, might there be a constitutional argument like this for protecting the climate?
The first thing I want to say about that is it's certainly a plausible argument that needs to be heard. And I don't believe that this cause of action should be thwarted in its infancy by courts finding that there's no standing to raise it. So I do think that they're certainly standing to raise it, because if the underlying cause of action exists, there are clearly people injured by it, and there are people being injured by it today, but certainly the younger generations are going to face even more emergency adverse conditions. You know, as to whether or not it exists, I think it's a complicated question constitutionally. And I, you know, I suppose some of it depends on, you know, your reading of the Constitution. I mean, I was in a House Judiciary Committee hearing the other day where there were anti-abortion people who showed up making the argument that fetuses are persons within the meaning of the Fifth and 14th Amendment. And so not only are they arguing for a reversal of Roe versus Wade, which would send everything back to the states for state laws, they're basically saying it's unconstitutional for a state ever to allow abortion, because it's as if a state is permitting the murder of part of the population. You know, and on that theory, Constitution protects the life of the fetus. Obviously, that's a dramatic and extreme constitutional argument. I think that probably has less compelling force than saying that, you know, all persons considered living under the Constitution today have a right to, you know, climate or environmental safety or security. One would argue, I suppose, that it's implied in the social contract of the Constitution. It's, you know, not entirely clear what that right means and how, you know, you would spell it out, and, you know, whether we would say that creates an affirmative duty or obligation upon the government to, you know, wrestle the oil barons to the ground and to, you know, come up with climate solutions. I don't know. I mean, I think it raises a fascinating question under the Constitution. I mean, it would be impossible to argue from the perspective of original intent or understanding that was built into the original constitutional compact, just because I don't think it ever occurred to anybody then. Nobody dreamed that we actually could be looking at the end of humanity or the end of our society from all of this. But, you know, I could also see very plausible arguments that this is built into the whole concept of creating a constitution, and that life, liberty, property, due process do imply a stable environment. But the truth is, I've not researched it, I've not written about it, and I don't know. But I certainly think it's worthy of exploration and consideration.
From what I know, this has been a long haul for these young people going to different states and different district courts. If this became a reality, couldn't a lot of things in the climate fight be able to point back to the constitutional right? A very useful tool, wouldn't it?
It would. I mean, you can look at like the Pennsylvania state constitution, where there is a right to environmental quality or environmental security. And that has been a very potent and fertile source of litigation and progress through the law. That's an explicit right that exists in the Pennsylvania Constitution. So I think if it were to be determined, I think that would be valuable.
You're listening to Tacoma Radio, WOWDLP 94.3 FM. This is Climate Seasons with Julie Handman and my guest, U.S. Congressman Jamie Raskin. I have one more question. It's looking like January 6th may have been a coordinated political coup attempt, and you're involved in investigating this. Do you see any connection between the threat to democracy on the one hand and the threats to our planet on the other?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's no way we're going to be able to summon up the political will and focus and courage to make the changes that we need to make in order to confront the civilizational emergency of climate change if we don't have a real functioning democracy in the United States. So the first step is we have to secure our democracy with the right to vote against all of the destabilizing right-wing threats. And then from there, once we really win that battle and put that threat to rest, we'll be able to galvanize and mobilize the country and the attention of the world to, you know, what is this civilizational crisis that we're in. But, you know, as for the coup part of it, I mean, that seemed clear to me from the very first day. I mean, the way I've thought about it is that there were three critical rings of activity that took place on January 6th. The outer ring was the realm of tens of thousands of protesters who were turned into rioters. They came because Donald Trump sent them a tweet or an email or a Facebook message or something, essentially telling them to come to Washington to stop the steal. And I think they had diffuse or ambiguous ideas about what exactly they would do, but their president was telling them they were needed, and they came, and they were drawn into a large crowd that was hyped up on Trump's extremist and apocalyptic rhetoric. And that crowd quickly became a mob. The second ring, or the middle ring of activity, was the space of the insurrection itself, where there were the three percenters, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Nations, the militiamen, the QAnon networks and followers. And these organized extremist groups from across the right wing and brought in from all parts of the country were the stormtrooper vanguard of of the protests. They knocked out the windows and began the physical assaults on the guards and the officers and so on. And many of them had been engaged in military training for January 6th. And of course, many of them are still out there and consider January 6th a great victory for their cause, except that they, you know, they condemn themselves for not going all the way, for having left their weapons and arms in the car or back at the hotel or the motel. And the rhetoric that I'm seeing now online is very much like the former sheriff from Florida who appeared at the QAnon network last weekend, I think it was, and said that that wasn't an insurrection. That was a frat party. When we have an insurrection, you'll know about it, but it will be too late for you to do anything. And that's basically the tenor of the remarks we've been hearing. But believe it or not, neither of those two rings is the scariest ring. The scariest ring was the innermost ring, which is the ring of the coup. And coup is a weird word to think of in the American political lexicon because we don't have a lot of experience with coups inside the United States. We think of a coup as something taking place against a president. This coup was organized by the president against the vice president to try to intimidate and coerce Mike Pence into rejecting electoral college votes unilaterally for the first time in American history. It's just not done. It's not contemplated by the Constitution. It's not allowed for in the Electoral Count Act, but they just wanted him to return the electors of Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, thereby lowering Joe Biden's total below 270 in Electoral College, occasioning a failure of a majority in the Electoral College. And that kicks it immediately into the House of Representatives under the 12th Amendment for a so-called contingent election. And if you're wondering why Donald Trump would want the electoral contest to be settled in the House of Representatives under Nancy Pelosi, it's because the 12th Amendment provides that we're not voting one member, one vote, we're voting one state delegation, one vote. Each state gets one vote. And after the 2020 election, the GOP had 27 state delegations in the House. We have 22. One, Pennsylvania, is tied, split right down the middle. I don't think that the 27th state, Wyoming, with my new best friend Liz Cheney being the sole at-large representative, would have voted for Trump there, but it still would have left Trump 26 votes in a majority to win in the contingent election against Joe Biden. And that's how they were aiming to thwart and destroy Joe Biden's victory. And Trump at that point probably would have declared martial law, invoking the Insurrection Act, and then using the National Guard, which he had been withholding all day, to put down the chaos that he had visited upon us with the protesters, the rioters, and the insurrectionists that were surrounding the coup. So we came very close, and who knows what would have happened at that point. I mean, it could have looked very much like a military dictatorship and, General Pinochet coming to power, or it could have turned into a civil war situation, because our colleagues always talk about the 74 million people who voted for Trump. What about the 81 million people who voted for Biden? And I think they're mistaken to think that those people would have simply accepted it at this point. I don't think so.
Thank you so much, Congressman Raskin, for joining Climate Seasons today.
Thank you for having me. Keep up the great work.
Oh, thanks a lot. Of course, outside of government, there are many ways to fight the climate crisis, and I hope listeners will look around and get involved. To hear past episodes of this show, go to climateseasons.org. I'm Julie Hantman. Up next, tunes from the music library. Look at you.